Other groups and organizations are talking about reparations today. It's because since 1982, we've taken a mass campaign out throughout this country and the world. We had the Irish Republican Socialist Party pass a resolution in Ireland supporting the reparations demand for black people. We did that in 1983. We had an organization in
And welcome to Voices of the People, here where we speak with African People's Socialist Party Chairman Amalia Shetela and African People's Solidarity Committee Chairwoman Penny Hess about the current events, the current situation that is going on in the world, particularly the economic crisis that imperialism is suffering from now, and as well as the constantly updating situation with Barack Obama, whose presidency is an attempt to solve that crisis. So we're gonna get started in a moment. I am your facilitator, Nyabinga Zimbabwe, and I do want to let you all know out there that you can participate in the discussion that we're going to be having here. Those of you who are listening to us outside of the studio can do so by calling one of our several numbers are emailing us. Our U.S. number is 727-565-1599. That's country code 001. You can call our U.K. number, which is 020-8133-6629, and that's country code 44. Or you can call us through Skype anywhere in the African world. Our Skype ID is Uhuru Radio, and that's all one word, all lowercase. Or email us at dj@uhururadio.com. Now, today we're going to take a brief look at the a brief update on the economy, and then we're going to discuss more about Barack Obama's cabinet nomination. So, Penny. Uhura, it's good to have you in. Can you give us a brief update on the economic situation this week?
Uhura, yes. And I just want to say Uhura to Chairman Omali Yeshitela. It's an honor to be here, and Uhura to everybody that's listening. And to say that that the economic situation for the parasitic capitalist economy is unbelievably dire. It's not really summed up all in one place that much, but when you look at all the figures and everything that's going on, it's really clear that we are in the collapse of the U.S. economy, that its days are numbered, and I mean days. I'm not talking about weeks or months. It's really going to be interesting to see how it unfolds. But some of the things that we've seen in this past week is there was a YouTube video out of just showing the Detroit Free Press, which is the main newspaper of Detroit, the foreclosures in Detroit and Wayne County. And it was a section of the paper, full newsprint size. I have no idea, but it looked like it was at least 100 listings per page, 137 pages of the foreclosures. And I think it was only from like November 16th to November 23rd or something like that. 137 pages of foreclosures in Detroit. And this is before the total collapse of the auto industry. So, you know, it's just incredible to think about, especially the conditions in Michigan and the Midwest and all over. I mean, this is hitting everything. We see this week we saw unemployment figures at a 16-year high with nearly 550,000 unemployment claims in the second week of November, with 4.1 million people on unemployment benefits. And the U.S. lost 1.2 million jobs this year so far. The automakers, I mean, I don't know, Chairman is probably going to comment on this maybe, but it's just so interesting because, first of all, they are laying off thousands. They're in bankruptcy, possibly no bailout right now, although I think definitely the Obama administration is going to try to do that. But here you have the Senate hearings, and the CEOs of General Motors flew on private jets to the Senate hearings while, you know, everybody else, all the workers are you know, getting laid off. And CEOs of Chrysler and these other other automakers are getting their full bonuses up to $1.8 million. While you know, the U.S. taxpayers are supposed to bail them out, but they're saying that if one goes down, if GM goes down, it will bring down all of them. That's going to be 3 to 4 million jobs, with at least 7 million pensions that will totally be collapsed and not have the ability to, you know, to work or have a living of any sort. And still in the auto union, I think it is still the highest African population within that union of any other union inside the United States. And I think it's interesting because Of course, the UAW is completely corrupt, but I just think that it's really interesting to see how the media is targeting the union. The problem, the reason that the automakers are bankrupt is because the union was demanding such high pay, and the union has made a statement that it will not renegotiate any of the salaries of the workers. But, you know, look at the bankers. I mean, the thing is that, you know, the bankers got everything they want in the $700 billion bailout. And now, you know, the media attacks a primarily African union. And I just think as being the problem. And I think that's interesting and typical. But also we have Citibank laying off 53,000. And just the other day, Paulson was on NPR saying all the financial institutions are stabilized. And then, of course, the next day, Citibank makes this announcement that it's laying off 53,000. Many of the banks and investment banks, et cetera, and Wall Street are laying off thousands and thousands of people. Also, we see the shipping crisis going on. There's an index called the Baltic Dry Index. That is the world index of all goods and metals and commodities that are moved through waterways in the world. And that index has dropped 92% in the last 5 months. So that's pretty amazing. And also, I think that it's really telling about a system built in the enslavement of African people and the waterways as the slave trade, because one of the reasons it's happening is because banks are not issuing what's called a letter of credit. And so when the ships come in, the people who are receiving it can't get a letter of credit, so they won't even unload these ships. And all over the world are ships that are full. They're just sitting there in the docks. Or, as in California, Los Angeles, the Port of Los Angeles, the Port of Long Beach, there are tens of thousands of Hondas and Toyotas sitting in storage or just in lots in the port, on the port, you know, grounds, because nobody will pick them up. They can't pick them up. But back to this letter of credit. The letter of credit dates back to the trade in African people. It is something that's been in existence through banks since the 1600s in the world. And so I just think that's very telling that the whole shipping trade is collapsing right now. And it's going to mean shortages. It's going to mean shortages of food, because we consider that 75% or whatever of what we use in the United States comes from China. We, you know, the U.S. imports everything. So it's going to be a very serious crisis. And in fact, in China right now, China, by the end of the year, will have closed 100,000 factories. And while their economy was not tainted by the subprime derivative mess, they didn't get into that. They're being desperately affected by the lack of consumption by the U.S. and Europe. So they are staving off a real revolutionary situation, or at least one of tremendous civil unrest there. They're saying that enormous demonstrations are happening. Like 800,000 workers are leaving the cities, going back to the countryside to their families to try to eke out a living. And China just put in a $500 billion stimulus to try to build roads and infrastructure in their country. But right now they have a very serious situation. In Southern California, the prices of houses are down 41%. I also think, back to the shipping thing, that it's really interesting that we see what's called this whole incident with the pirates, quote-unquote, of Somalia, who captured the largest oil tanker in the world, the Sirius Star, and they still have it. They still have it, you know. And this is in waters that is being patrolled by 14 NATO warships constantly. And I just think that's really interesting because obviously piracy historically were England and Britain and countries that were struggling to get part of the trade in African people, and piracy was about raiding the ships. And now those pirates are heralded as heroes, and here in Tampa they have big parades and all kinds of celebration of pirates. So pirates are just, you know, people struggling for part of the loot of parasitic capitalism, but who don't have state power. And I just think that the situation in Somalia is really interesting because it's very sophisticated, and it's no little deal. It's not people with rowboats. It's a really big operation. We also see this week the stock market is below 8,000. It only came up on Friday with the announcement that of the new Secretary of the Treasury named under Obama, Timothy Geithner. Geithner, I think is how you say it. And I just think that's a telling story. The stock market came up 500 points on Friday for the first time in weeks, and that shows that he's a friend of Wall Street. They like him. They see that as a positive thing. So it tells us who he is, and we'll talk a little bit more about him in a minute. Also, this week was issued a U.S. National Intelligence Council report that predicts the decline of U.S. power with global wealth and power shifting from east to west, quote, without precedent in modern history, over the next 20, 25 years. I don't think it'll really take that long, but that is what they're talking about. And it's, you can find that by Googling it. I don't have a website with me right now, but you can easily find that report, and people should read it. It's very interesting. But I think it's interesting because the report that was issued in 2004, as Bush was coming in for a second term, predicted the continuation of U.S. hegemony in the world and U.S. power. And in just 4 years, you know, they're having to deal with this completely different, you know, new, at least admission of this crisis of imperialism. And then just the last thing I wanted to report on is that there's a lot of predictions floating around on different websites that this week even, and some of these web predictions are very dead on accurate, so I don't know, but that at least soon that there will be a collapse of the COMEX, and the COMEX is the index of commodities and metals out of New York. And that is where gold is traded, for one thing, as well as all commodities, which have been in a deflationary spiral at the moment. But that the gold, not real gold in hand, but the gold futures or sort of stocks in gold have been oversold, and that countries like Russia and Iran, they're demanding the real gold for it, and that the COMEX has oversold those stocks and they don't have it, and that will create a collapse of the whole COMEX system, basically the commodities and metals market of the United States, and could precipitate a rapid collapse of the dollar. So those are just some highlights of the collapse of parasitic capitalism built on the enslavement of African people and the genocide of the indigenous people. That's what's happening this week.
All in time for Thanksgiving. I want to open it up for questions from our studio audience or those of you listening out there. Just to kick it off, I'm wondering. so, with you're saying with the announcement of this new guy over as the Treasury Secretary, that the stock is going up, but it
went up for one day, one afternoon. It went up 500 points and got up above 8,000 for the first time in a while.
It might be worth explaining the relationship between consumption in the United States and Europe and the deepening problems with China. that might be something you might want to elaborate on to help people understand, because you mentioned that that with the slowdown in consumption because of the crisis in the United States and Europe, fewer people rushing to the malls anymore, which are themselves in the process of collapsing. That represents a problem for China. Can you say something about that?
Yes, Chairman. Well, the U.S. gross domestic product is 72 to 75% consumption. And that means that the U.S. is not a productive country. It's not a country with its own factories. It's a country whose whole economy is based on parasitic capitalism, sort of the ultimate extreme of that, which is just pure consumption, buying things. I mean, if everybody remembers, after the attacks of September 11th, 2001, the government, the first thing that it said to the U.S. population was, do your patriotic duty and go out and buy an SUV and buy cars and buy things so the economy will stay okay. And this is right now that because the economy is – and this means, by the way, that this consumption has been built on or fueled by debt, just like the government is based on something like a couple billion dollars a day of borrowing money in order to function. The civilian, you know, regular population of the U.S. has been consuming through debt, through credit card debt, home equity loans, other kinds of things. And this is coming to an end, a rapid end, because the economy is collapsing, credit is drying up. And, there's no place else to go. People are losing their jobs in record numbers, and they can't continue to operate on debt, so they can't consume anymore. And this is creating the thing. In fact, I think the chairman was talking about one time how one of the few things that the U.S. continues to export is cardboard, and it exports it to China so that it can fill up those boxes with TVs and toys and ship it back here. And it's interesting, Chairman, because in this article that I was reading in the LA Times about all these cars, these Toyotas and Hondas that are coming in, and no of the 10-wheeler car, you know, what do you call them, car trailers or whatever, are coming to pick them up at all. They're just sitting there in the port, and the port doesn't want to do, but it's also saying that all this cardboard to be shipped to China is just sitting there too, because China doesn't want the cardboard anymore. So the ports are full of cardboard and cars. And, you know, this is just telling of the consumer society. And I just think that, you know, it's like we see the reciprocal, well, no, I guess we see the residual of this still going on in the U.S., because a lot of people don't have a clue of this crisis. And the crisis has hit the financial sector, and it still might be a few weeks or a few months before it hits sort of the streets in the same way, when people really feel that they don't have any money, they don't have jobs, they get evicted more and more from their housing. We're going to see a lot more when they can't get groceries, they can't get consumer goods that they need. We're going to see the crisis on the streets, you know, coming really soon. But last night I had to go to International Mall because my computer got froze up. So I had to go to the Apple store to get it worked on. And that mall was totally packed. This is one of the poshest malls, I guess, in Tampa. It was totally packed. I mean, nobody has told them yet,
you know, that
we're in this crisis, I guess. I don't know, but anyway, it's interesting.
Before we move on, excuse me, I just want to mention, Comrade Penny mentioned earlier how there's this tendency to blame Africans for the crisis that they're experiencing, and of course, they blame Africans for the subprime mortgage crisis, even though we had these predatory lenders who, you know, conned and tricked and seduced people into taking the mortgages, and then this thing with the so-called Somali pirates, I think, is another example of that. And there is some history to this process, because the fact is that the people in Somalia are living in most desperate circumstances, and where the U.S. has initiated proxy war led by puppet Ethiopian regime that's attacking forces who had come close to resolving a profound problem in Somalia that has existed at least since the presidency of George Herbert Walker Bush, where they had purchased land, that is to say, they, a consortium of oil corporations, and they had discovered all this oil under Somalia. I think they call it a lake of oil under Somalia, stretching all the way to Yemen. And they engineered a profound crisis that prevented the ascension to power in Somalia of someone who they didn't want in power. I think it was Adid, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. And Somalia was attacked. It has not had a strong centralized consolidated state since the 90s, since the early 90s, when that occurred. Of course, Clinton carried out, you know, followed up with the war, and it was at a time where they called this war making against Somalia peacekeeping, and they were going to go in and provide, you know, like they were helping the poor people, that kind of mission. The U.S. ambassadors was located in, I think it was the oil company corporation, Conoco Oil, was where the ambassadors was headquartered. The U.S. embassy was effectively at Conoco Oil Corporation. So since that time, the U.S. has opposed the consolidation of the Somali state behind any strong, significant kind of leader, something that would have prevented it, would have allowed the Somali government to protect his own and define and protect his own interests. And so at the juncture, one group seemed to have come close to power. They were characterized by the United States as al-Qaeda related to justify increasing war made against the Somali state, and they used the Ethiopian troops to carry out this attack there. And so the people are literally starving, and have situations of a number of forces characterized as warlords with semblances of neighborhood states, just armed forces who control portions of the country at any given time. And in the middle of the starving, some entrepreneurs, so to speak, have simply decided that the oil, the shipping lanes should be targets for acquiring resources, at least for somebody in Somalia. And that's where the whole piracy thing was born out of that. So it is not a matter of simplest reckless or criminal behavior on Somalia. The Somalis are responding the best way possible under the circumstances that's been created for them by the U.S. and imperialism in general. That I say the best way possible, short of course, of a revolutionary solution. What needs to happen is the African Socialist International has to be consolidated in East Africa, and has to galvanize the Somali workers and peasants in a revolutionary process that connects the struggles in Somalia to the struggles of African people throughout the continent and around the world in pursuit of political power. consolidation of one liberated Africa united. But anyway, the point is that, you know, people read the newspapers and they read about pirates and they have their own, they have few references with which to use to try and understand what's happening other than that which is, you know, given to them by the media, which function as part of the criminals that's responsible for what's happening and certainly for how people understand it around the world.
Go ahead, Penny.
I just wanted to, Chairman, yeah, thank you for that overview on, and the, you know, and why there has to be the African Socialist International and what the conditions are and, you know, colonialism and why African people have to control Africa's resources. And I just wanted to add on that how important it is, because it is the, you know, it's the Persian Gulf that we're talking about. It's the Straits of Hormuz, where something like 90% of the oil of the entire world goes through. And it is a really powerful thing, because it said that Maersk, which is the largest shipping line in the world, is now going to have to go through the Mediterranean and down through, you know, under Africa, the Cape of Good Hope in southern Africa, to go around to Asia to take oil. And it's a really powerful move that they're doing, and they haven't been, you know, they haven't been caught yet. They still have that tanker, that Saudi Arabian tanker. And I just think that it is really powerful to see when all of these struggles, like in Nigeria and the diamond struggles that are going on and Sierra Leone, are brought together under the ASI.
Well, the thing about that is, of course, the reason for digging that ditch that they call that separated Israel from what they call Israel from the rest of Africa was so that they could get around having to do the shipping all around the continent as they are being forced to do now. And that is a statement about the strategic significance of an all-African response to what is happening to Africa, and the strategic significance not only of a consolidated African revolutionary movement for Africa, but for the entire world. If Africa were responsive to an African Socialist International, where we were existing effectively in all of the 11 districts or regions that we've created for the African Socialist International, then there's hardly any place that the imperialist economy could function without the willingness of Africans ourselves. So I just think it's again something that validates the real need to consolidate, to continue pushing to develop the African Socialist International, and also it exposes the short-sightedness of all of those who actually think that somehow you win your freedom in these little territories without being connected to the struggles of African people everywhere else, because the imperialists do not function in that fashion. Even in as they disagree, they have an arrangement and a relationship that allow them to create organizations that are determined to maintain at least imperialist control and imperialist hegemony over Africa, over the sea lanes, over the Middle East, and the rest of the world, for that matter. So we have to think in terms like that. And one of the problems that we are confronted with is that the African revolutionaries, as they are called, do not have long views too often, and still have consciousness confined to the borders that have been imposed on us by imperialism, whether they exist in, unfortunately, in places like Nigeria or South Africa or the United States, etc., they appear mostly only to see the world through the lenses that have been constructed by the imperialists and the colonialists, and have locked us into these, you know, separate little enclaves. And we can only be free, and we can only advance the African and then the world revolution if we consolidate, build, and recognize the urgency of building and consolidating the African Socialist International that will give us a revolutionary international capacity and therefore a strategic capacity on every front in the African world.
We're talking here on Voices of the People with Chairman Omali Eshetela and Chairwoman Penny Hess about the crisis of imperialism as it represents itself economically and otherwise. You can participate in this discussion that we're having by calling in to one of our various numbers. The U.S. number is 727-565-1599. That's country code 001. You can call the U.K. number, which is 020-8133-6629, and that's country code 44. Or you can call us through Skype anywhere in the African world. Our Skype ID is Uhuru Radio, and that's all one word, all lowercase. Or email us at dj@uhururadio.com. Those in the studio, if you have any questions, you can pose them now.
Uhuru, well, that was... I had a question on the economy section of the discussion, so I hate to...
Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I know I've been hearing a lot on the radio. They'll do reports about updates about the economy, and they'll always say stuff like, they haven't been this low in the last 15 years, or they haven't been this low since, you know, the last 7 years or something like that. And I always thought, well, what went so bad then? Like, I don't remember it. Like, how can that be that it was this bad 15 years ago? But then the other day I heard one guy on the radio saying it hasn't been this bad since they started recording these numbers 15 years ago. So my question, I guess, is that, you know, if you're just listening to mainstream media and not to Uhuru Radio, you know, it's like the economists and people reporting are leading us to believe that it has... You know, this is not something new, or it's, you know, it's not this new desperate territory. So I'm just wondering, my question, I guess, is, has it ever been this bad before?
Okay, I don't know if you want to answer that.
Uhuru, well, I would just say on that, well, first of all, they do cover over the seriousness of it. But secondly, it is significant, even if it is the worst in 5 years or the worst in 15 years, because parasitic capitalism, which is built on stealing the resources, the labor, the land of other peoples, needs constant, infinite growth. It can't stay the same. To stay the same is to collapse, to stay the same size. It is. You remember, if you follow it at all, it's always the gross domestic product this year has to grow. And so even just to say that it went back 5 years is a serious problem for them. And that is what's happening. It is contracting. And, you know, just to, as being a member of the African People's Solidarity Committee, the organization of white people working under the leadership of the African People's Socialist Party, and dealing with the white community, I mean, it's just going to be really interesting to see what the response from the white community is going to increasingly be. And it's going to be very much an attack on African and other peoples from a lot of people. I mean, that happened in other economic collapses in the United States in the 1890s, in the 1930s, and et cetera. And so, you know, but I think that it's really clear, like just from what you were saying, Chairman, that as the U.S. economy collapses and it's based on sucking the blood of the people on the planet Earth, as that collapses, and it is right now, people are looking to China, and China being the upcoming economy. But the reality is
that the question that's going to come to fore is the resources of the world. And as you said, Africa has the majority of the resources that everybody needs to function, whether they're capitalist or not. And people need it to function. And it just seems like that this period is coinciding with the growth of the ASI and the realization of the power that African people have in their hands to control the resources and kill capitalism that way. And for white people, you know, we have to say that our future is there, because there's no future on this Titanic. And, you know, unless we all want to go down with it, we have to stand with the rising of Africa and African working people that we're going to liberate this planet.
I just want to say that the future does rest with Africa, and this is where we are confronted with the limitations of ideology throughout the world, but particularly my primary immediate concern is the ideological limitations within the African world. Again, where we are and how we are characterized today in the world is due to verdicts by imperialism. Imperialism has defined the political and economic contours of the entire world, and to the point that we accept our designations as African Americans or as Afro-Canadians or Germans or as Sudanese or Somalis and the whole gamut of things, even when we change the names from South Africa to a Zania and then call this group of people in this area that has been defined by the imperialists as a Zanian or as a group among ourselves, only unto ourselves, while the whole imperialist world, the whole world economy, there is a world economy. There is no Azania economy. The economy of Azania, of occupied Azania, the economy of Somalia, the economy of Nigeria, all of them are part of an imperialist economy that has been constructed at the expense of the well-being of the producers in all of these places. And when I say producers, I'm talking about the workers. I'm talking about the people who would be the custodians of the land where all the minerals are held, et cetera. So if you got this limited worldview, if you suffer from this ideological deficit, then you come up with bad political conclusions and actions that you want to employ to change your circumstances so that you can, you know, we're going to have another South African revolution, and then we're going to have another Nigerian, and then we're going to have over and over again. And all of these things continue to exist within a world economy that is seamless, that is controlled by the imperialists. So if you have this bad ideology, you have this distorted ideology, this distorted worldview, it comes up with bad political determinations. And we can see that to some extent even in this country in particular with this Obama phenomenon. I say this country, I'm talking specifically about the United States right now, because the contradiction that Africans are suffering from is not the absence of an African or a black man as the president of the empire. That's not the contradiction we're suffering from. In fact, his presence there is testimony to the crisis of the imperialist system itself. And because even, you know, you think the ones who just came forward with this intelligence admonition or concern or about the future of America just came up with it today when they talk about the waning influence of U.S. imperialism, when they talk about how the U.S. Is going to be losing influence throughout the world and primarily to places like China and India.
I would contend to you that this was something they already knew, and that Obama, in part, is a response to that. And to the extent that peoples anywhere, including in America, what they call America, can unite or somehow feel that America is rehabilitated, or we are rehabilitated because an African is at the helm of the empire, it is extraordinarily missing the point and misunderstanding what we have to do. The African People's Socialist Party understands what we have to do. And that's why we put forth the African Socialist International as a response. And our response is not to find a better person to manage the assets that the imperialists are losing control of, or to find a better captain for the Titanic that's already hit the iceberg. Our response is to overturn our relationship with imperialism, and also to assist all those other peoples around the world who are struggling against imperialism, so that we can know a better future for all of humanity. And that's the thing that we have to do. And when you look at this issue of waning U.S. influence, what you have to understand, when you talk about a political economy, you're not just talking about the banks. You're talking about the entire political economic construct. A waning U.S. influence means that the ability of the U.S. To command access to all of these resources, the ability of imperialism itself, as it exists, to continue to thrive, is being seriously challenged. And so we have to build a revolutionary solution. I just want to say this because I know that we don't have much time, but particularly for African people, when you look at the phenomenon of Barack Obama, Barack Obama being president is not a consequence of anything that planning or organizing that has been done by any Africans, any group of Africans who have said, look, let's run this guy to advance our interests. Oh, Barack Obama is president because of organizing and planning that was done by people who have already been tied to the empire, who are part of imperialism. So for some people, and I'm really offended by these pseudo-nationalists who are nothing but white nationalists and black skin, to say that somehow because Barack Obama is elected president, it's going to give my child a sense of pride to see a black man presiding over the empire. It is extraordinary. We have to build a revolutionary movement. There is no solution outside of revolution. African People's Socialist Party understands this, and this is the information and organization that we're trying to take around the world in order to get our people and the world out of this fix that imperialism has had us in for the last 500 years. Uhura.
Yeah. Uhura. We're going to get into talking about the cabinet selections of Barack Obama. Before we do that, I want to read a question from one of our listeners who says, Uhuru, this question is for Chairwoman Penny Hess. I really appreciate your analysis on this economic crisis. I know that the retail industry is also going under, but have you heard about the increase in gun sales? A report came out saying that there are a 40% increase. Why do you think this is happening now, and what does it mean for African people? Ona Zene.
No, I think Penny should address the question, but I think the question more appropriately put would be that there's a 40% increase in gun sales, apparently, to white people. I think we should address that question. Yeah. So, Penny.
Uhuru. Well, yeah, and it's interesting because I'm sure it's all guns, but in particular, it's assault rifles that you can't even get right now. I mean, it's heavy duty armaments that white people were buying, and while this whole myth of post-racial America, I mean, you're reading about it every day and out in Pennsylvania and West Virginia and most states. I mean, white people are, and Florida is one of the biggest places.
you know, white people are angry at Obama being the president, and you know, there's going to be deep consequences of this. We're just going to see, you know, white people are ready to go into a white nationalist war against African and other colonized peoples in this country. And as the economy deepens and worsens, we're going to see that. It's going to be there every day.
I think it's true that there's probably a lot of anger in the white community around the Obama election. But I think beyond that, that most white people are like most Africans and don't understand the nature of the system and don't understand the fact that Obama's election is an instance, is a choice of imperialism, of white power itself, that he represents white power. I think that the ideological foundation of imperialism and American imperialism, the racial, which is, you know, racism itself, assumes that, allows white people to assume that black people, many white people anyway, that there are black people who have power now as a consequence of Obama's election, and that this thing is going to inspire or somehow otherwise influence the struggle for power by black people. And I think that those people are buying guns in order to make sure that that black people don't come to power or to protect themselves from what they think are the black hordes that will take over everything. I think that's, you know, part of what we're looking at. And the irony here, of course, is that the majority of the African people probably do think we have power because Obama is there, and probably wouldn't have to buy a gun because Obama is there. And you got all these white people who, many of whom think that Obama's being there is a suggestion that black people will somehow struggle or somehow come closer to achieving power or taking over America or something to that effect, and they're buying guns to make sure that it doesn't happen. So you got a defenseless African colonized population, and this is one of the crimes that I truly believe that those who call themselves leaders of in our community, I'm talking now about the so-called nationalists and so-called revolutionaries, this is one of the things that I think makes their behavior so criminal, as opposed to arming the mass of African people with an understanding of what this election was about and who Obama is as a representative of imperialist white power. They have got the mass of African people to come back into the Democratic Party, into the system, and to rely on the Democratic Party and Obama for solutions, even as a huge sector of the civilian white population is arming itself to contend with what they think could be a meaningful resistance by African people.
I want to go into, in the time that we have, Obama's cabinet selections. Penny, can you lay out some of the main choices that have been made for Obama's cabinet? We've got about 8 minutes left.
Uhuru. Well, yes, and you know, maybe we can go into it more next week. But
yes.
I did want to say about the Attorney General choice, Eric Holder. In particular, it's because he is portrayed in the media as a liberal and a social justice advocate. And it's really important that we understand that, in fact, he is a DOJ, Department of Justice, insider who's been part of that for a long time. He was assistant attorney general under Janet Reno, under Clinton, in the Clinton administration. And he's been, U.S. attorney in Washington, D.C., and has played a key role in the counterinsurgency against African people in this country, which I want to go into a second. But his appointment is clearly signaling that Obama will make no changes on the prison population of young African or African people in this country, of reaching, you know, in the millions. No changes in the police brutality and police murders that we're seeing. No changes in the martial law, the SWAT teams murdering everybody from African children to elderly people day after day. This is what he stands for. This is what he built his career on. Just to say a little bit about him, that Holder, while he was assistant attorney general during the passing of the crime bill under Clinton, which put 100,000 new police on the streets and put $9.7 billion investment into prisons, that Holder, his job was to implement getting those 100,000 police actually on the job in cities, urban areas, and African communities all over the country. So, you know, he, and I think it's really interesting too, because one of the things that the crime bill was supposed to do, one of its mandates, is that it's supposed to keep a national registry or record of police brutality. And he never implemented that. And it's still completely impossible to get data on that. I mean, we say that more Africans have been killed by the police than U.S. soldiers have been killed in the Iraq War in that same time period. But that's just an estimate based on looking at newspapers and stuff. But there's no records kept at all whatsoever. And people have said, well, they couldn't because it would be embarrassing to police departments. So he never did that. He supports mandatory minimums. In fact, he came out in support of tougher mandatory minimums, even for marijuana, in addition to crack and everything else, and keeping the discriminatory sentencing. Holder played a role in crafting the updated USA Patriot Act in 2001. He was on the team, on Bush's team, to do that. When he was working as a private attorney, he negotiated the agreement with the Justice Department that got Chiquita Banana in Colombia, which was paying protection money to right-wing death squads that had killed 4,000, mostly African and indigenous people. It was death squads there, just like it is here. He negotiated on behalf of Chiquita Banana, got them off the hook. Nobody went to jail for that, and they only had to pay like a $25 million fine, which is nothing for them. So, you know, he's also being singled out by the bourgeois media for playing a role in the Mark Rich pardon, who was this, you know, at the end of Clinton's term, a buddy of Clinton's who was a rich, you know, gangster. Well, I guess he was something in Wall Street or a financier or something, yeah, who did some things. He was also under Janet Reno during the Waco attack that killed, you know, those people in the church in Texas. And, you know, this is the kind of guy that he is. So he's a clear signal that the counterinsurgency, the death squads inside the U.S. will continue and deepen. I wanted to say quickly about Janet
Napoleon. Should have mentioned that he's African, Justin.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
So another black face.
Yeah.
Exactly. He is African, and he is the first African attorney general. And, you know, and again, like a lot of the leftist sites are saying that this is a step forward from Alberto Gonzalez. Well, there's really, you know, when you look at him and Janet Napolitano, there's really not that much difference. They're the same thing. And Napolitano, who is the governor of Arizona, was named Secretary of Homeland Security. And she is particularly known for her very vicious and stringent stand against Mexican workers in this country. I mean, she fought for the border fence or border wall. She called the National Guard on the border. She's just vicious in that way. And she will be working with Joe Lieberman, who got to keep his place in the Senate as the head of the Homeland Security in the Senate. So together, they are Alberto Gonzalez 50 million times over. Exactly.
I know there's so much more. There's so much more. And it's all right, because we're going to continue this discussion on next week. Those of you who want to hear more information on Obama's cabinet of lack of change, I guess, tune in next week, because we're going to continue talking about that here on Voices of the People on uhururadio.com. Uhuru.
Alive. What I'm saying is, ain't nobody gonna do this for us but us. Talk about a Barack Obama. Don't even talk to me about Barack Obama. Let's talk about Marcus Garvey. You know what I'm saying? The question ain't whether we vote for white power and white face or white power and black face. The question is whether we will be an independent people, or whether we remain colonized and oppressed until we are wiped out. This is African internationalism in action, y'all. Y'all need to get up on this. When we say we have to have power in our own hands, here we're talking about the African working class. What we can do is to have an organized capacity of the African workers in alliance with the poor peasants, who takes state power for itself. Then we can begin to say we got justice in our own hands.
Africa Live.
Up these incredible African leaders that we've had. It's critical that as African people we strive to be like them. I'm talking about the Marcus Garveys. I'm talking about the Fannie Lou Hamers. I'm talking about the Malcolm X's, the Kwame Nkrumahs, and today we have Omali Eshitella.
Brothers and sisters, Africans at home and abroad, welcome to Africa Live. Uhuru, and welcome to Africa Live here on uhururadio.com. I'm your host, Yabinga Zimbabwe, and we've got a great show lined up for you today. We'll be talking with Dr. Aisha Fields, who is the director of the All African Peoples Development and Empowerment Project, an incredible project that has been providing water purification in places like Western Africa, Sierra Leone, and is involved in a number of other projects, including a borehole project in Zimbabwe, and is, you know, is doing incredible kind of work. Now, Dr. Aisha Fields is also one of the Huntsville Three. Three Africans, all tied to the Uhuru movement, all members of the Uhuru movement, who were arrested for observing the police, and have been on trial. And so we're going to be talking about that. I have on the air with me Dr. Aisha Fields. Uhuru, Doc.
Comrade, thank you for having me.
It's great to have you on. It's great to have you on, comrade. I know there are some people who may not be familiar with the case. So if you can you give people an idea of what it is that happened on that day?
Sure. Every year, the city of Huntsville, there's something that's called the June Black Arts Festival. And it's something that a local radio station puts on every year. And, you know, it's basically an opportunity for Africans to come together and enjoy, you know, music and, you know, African culture. And it attracts about 35,000 Africans from throughout the Southeast. And this year, the June Black Arts Festival took place basically right across the street from our home. And as anybody who is an African or who has spent any time in the African community knows, whenever numbers of African people gather, the police, you know, really ramp up their occupation in the African community. And the policing during the June Black Arts Festival is even more heavy-handed than it normally is in the African community. And it just so happened that on the 29th of June, my family and I were traveling to take my mother to the airport. She had been in town, and she was heading back to Philadelphia to home. And we had stopped at a gas station in our community to get some gas on the way to the airport. And the arts festival had, you know, just concluded. And so there were some people at the gas station, you know, buying gas and going inside the, you know, mini mart and purchasing things. And so as we pulled up to the gas station to, you know, to fill up the tank, we noticed that across the pump from us there were some officers, you know, harassing a young African couple who were, you know, attempting to get gas. And we noticed that in a matter of moments, the situation started to escalate, and we could notice that the police were, you know, yelling at the sister and yelling at the brother and telling them to throw their hands on the car. And so, you know, Kobina and I, who, you know, began to stand by our vehicle and observe the officers to let them know that they were being watched. And Kobina began to take pictures of the officers as they harassed the couple. While my mother was attempting to get gas, we had three children in the back seat of the car, one-year-old, 7 months, and four. So, you know, my mother was, you know, trying to get gas, and Kobina and I were by our vehicle observing the officers harass the young couple. And the cops basically just got agitated, you know, because they were being watched. They got caught harassing people, you know, and they didn't like that. And so they told us we had to go. We let them know we understood that we had a right to observe them. We weren't interfering. We were observing them by our vehicle. And they didn't like that. So they attempted to, you know, intimidate us. And when they couldn't do that, the officers came to arrest Kobina. And as they were attempting to arrest him for observing them, I was trying to get badge numbers. And before I know it, they called for backup. An officer came from behind me, grabbed me, ran me to a cop car. I'm not sure how many feet away, quite a distance, slammed me on top of the car. Another officer took my mother, who was attempting to get gas, grabbed her, slammed her against the car, arrested the three of us, put us in separate cop cars, threatened to take our children into state custody. We were able to get somebody to come get the children so that they weren't taken into the custody of the police. And now we face charges of resisting arrest and obstructing governmental operations, and just had trial this past Friday.
And I understand that that some of y'all got some injuries out of that incident.
Yes. In fact, my mother, Dr. Michelle Strongfield, who was attempting to get gas, because she was thrown so violently against the car, she actually had to be hospitalized twice. Once while she was here in Huntsville, she had to be hospitalized due to injuries to her knee and excessively high, you know, blood pressure. She has no history of high blood pressure whatsoever, but as a result of the injury and likely the stress behind, you know, behind the attack that was made on us, she, you know, had to be hospitalized for her really high blood pressure and injury to her knee. And then when she returned to Philadelphia, she also had to be hospitalized again for the same, for injury to her knee and her blood pressure.
Now, I know we can't talk much right now about the actual trial, because I understand that the judge's ruling is not out yet. And so I'm not going to ask you, you know, what happened in the trial. But I'd like to know, leading up to the trial, what has MPDUM been doing to organize, you know, to get justice in this case?
Well, immediately, you know, after we were arrested, the MPDUM organized a calling campaign to the jail, to the then mayor Loretta Spencer's office, and Councilman Richard Showers, who is the councilman for the district where we live, and to the police chief Henry Reyes. And that was the beginning of the campaign that MPDUM, you know, has been involved in around the case, around our case. On the ground here in Huntsville, we were able to form a committee of MPDUM, which is called the Huntsville Committee Against State Terror, which has really been successful in winning local people who were not, you know, initially tied to MPDUM to come into a committee that would work to not only, you know, make people aware of what was happening in our case, but to organize the African community in general around the question of the police containment in the African community, and really raising the issues that really all of us in the African community here in Huntsville are well aware of, and that is that, you know, there are policies that allow police officers to come into the African community, harass, brutalize, you know, African people at will, you know, deny us any kind of democratic right whatsoever. And so we've been able to as the Huntsville Committee Against State Terror, which is a committee of MPDUM, to be able to have regular protests at city council meetings, in front of the local city jail, which has just has been something that has been expanded to be able to take, I think, about $25 million of money here in Huntsville, taxpayer money, to expand the jail here to put more African people, you know, into the system, the prison system here in Huntsville. And so we've had protests throughout the city. We've organized several forums in different communities, here in Huntsville, raising questions of how we as African people are going to be able to organize ourselves to address the fact that we need community control over the police, you know, dealing with other areas of how the state imposes its will on African people. And we recently just had a forum at Alabama A&M University last weekend where we were able to really bring people into what we believe is going to be a serious movement here in Huntsville to address the question of police containment in the African community. And so we've been able to build quite a bit of momentum in the city through organizing around this case and greater issues of police containment here in Huntsville.
What's been the response from the community to this work?
You know, people have really been very supportive of this campaign, and I think mainly because, you know, people, you know, we've not really met anybody who can honestly say, any African who can honestly say they've not been impacted negatively by the police here. And people have really shown a lot of unity with the fact that, you know, not only are we trying to win justice in the case of the Huntsville 3, but that we understand that the attack that was made on us as being an attack, just one example of many attacks that are made daily on African people, you know, throughout Huntsville. And so people have really been, you know, opening up in terms of instances where they themselves have been attacked by police. Matter of fact, just recently, there was an expose in the Huntsville Times that showed that two officers in the North Precinct, where the same precinct where the officers who were involved in our case come from, had been found planting drugs on African people in the community. Hmm. And whenever we would do outreach, even prior to this expose that happened in Huntsville, in the Huntsville Times, we would go and do outreach, and Africans would tell us, you know, my son was beaten up by the police, and they planted drugs on him, they planted weed on him, or, you know, and certain officers' names would be mentioned quite regularly, and these are some of the same officers who now we found have been found planting drugs, you know, in the community, and have been exposed now by, you know, people outside of the African community, so now it's been given some kind of credibility. But, you know, what we found is that people have been quite appreciative of the fact that this is something that's being addressed organizationally and giving people an opportunity to move beyond their own individual disgust with an individual situation, but giving people an opportunity to organize around how we're going to change this situation in our communities.
We're speaking now with Dr. Aisha Fields, director of the All African People's Development and Empowerment Project, as well as one of the Huntsville 3. And would like to invite those of you out there listening to participate in this discussion that we're having. You can call into one of our various numbers, or you can email us. Our U.S. number is 727-565-1599, and that's country code 001. Our U.K. number is 020-8133-6629, and that's country code 44. Or you can call us through Skype anywhere in the African world for free. Our Skype ID is Uhuru Radio, and that's all one word, all lowercase. Or email us at dj@uhururadio.com. Dr. Fields, I want to know also, has there been any response from the state, you know, in all this organizing work that's being done in Huntsville around this case? Has there been any response from the state?
Absolutely. In fact, you know, when we first really began to organize here locally around the case, we presented, the city council with an opportunity to try to see if they would be willing to stand on the right side of things and help, especially the city councilman who is an African, who is a city councilman for the district where we live, where this attack took place, to see if he could unite with trying to stand on the side of the community and push for a community-based police review board, if he would be willing to try to use his position to be able to, you know, push for this demand that's coming from the community. And, you know, he has refused so far to even entertain any kind of discussion with the community around that. And, you know, we've also, it's interesting. This has been an election season here locally for city council and mayor. And so as part of the campaign that we were involved in here around the case, we had gone to several places where the candidates, the city council and the mayoral candidates were going to have debates and whatnot. And so at every instance, we would raise the question, what about the black community? How are you, if you're to win this mayoral race? How are you if you're to win this city council race? How are you if you're going to win school board race? How will you address these issues that affect the African community? How will you address the question of police containment in the African community? How will you address police containment in the schools where African children attend? And there have been, people who would afterwards say, we will, we really unite with what you all are doing. We want to be able to help around your case. You know, the person who has since become the new mayor of Huntsville, Mayor Tommy Battle, we raised directly to him while he was campaigning, what will you do to make sure that African people have, the ability to move in our communities without fear of police attack? And he said, as mayor, the first thing I would do was have the discussion. We would have the discussion with you because we want to be able to see what we could do to end such kinds of things in African community. Of course, this is somebody who was running, attempting to win the mayoral race by getting the black vote, by making sure that he could highlight every instance where the current mayor was, not meeting the needs of the African community and how he would do something differently. So subsequent to his winning the election because of the black vote in particular, we raised at city council, when are we going to be able to have an opportunity to see how you as mayor are going to do something about this police attack that's been made and is being made daily in the African community? And his response, as well as the other people who had won city council, who had before the election promised and vowed to do something about police containment, police attacks in the African community, told us in the city council they would not meet with us, they would not talk with us, they would not do anything because they do not unite with our organizations, politics, as the Uhuru movement, and they would refuse to do anything to address the African community because they don't want to have any. We don't stand on the right side of the question as it relates to the community, and they refuse to to do anything about it. So we have seen also too that we're not going to talk about the case, but I will say that typically in municipal court there will be any number of cases taking place in one courtroom. Well, our court case was the only one the whole day in its own courtroom, where every other case the whole day was in other courtrooms. And we see this as an attempt from the state to be able to try to isolate us for the community to not be aware of, what they're attempting to do in our case and to isolate us from the community. So we've seen and we understand that the state has really been making every effort, even when we do protests, to try to find ways that they can stop protests that we're doing, trying to throw ordinances, sound ordinance things at us and that kind of thing. So there's really been a real effort on the part of the state to isolate us from the community, to try to keep any kind of protests from happening, and to try to paint us as people who don't really speak for the interests of the general population of African people here in Huntsville.
Well, we're talking again with Dr. Aisha Fields, the director of APDEP, the All African People's Development and Empowerment Project, and one of the Huntsville Three. We're talking about the case of the Huntsville Three who were attacked by police in Huntsville, Alabama. I almost said Huntsville, Florida, but I don't think there is one in Florida. but we're going to continue this discussion after this brief break. But stay tuned and be prepared to participate in this discussion.
Organized. I'm taking what's rightfully mine, y'all. Liberation. taxes. That's why crime goes up. And I'm tired. Living my life just waiting to die. I'm tired. So tired. It's very instant. It's time for resistance, y'all.
That was Uhuru featuring, that's actually by Brothers Keeper out of, I believe, Mississippi, either Mississippi or Tennessee. I hate that I've forgotten, but his name of the song is Uhuru, and it's featuring the Brittenham Twins. It's a nice track. I really like that track. Anyway, we've been speaking with Dr. Aisha Fields, who, again, is the director of APDEP, the All African Peoples Development and Empowerment Project, and one of the Huntsville Three, three members of the Uhuru movement who were attacked by police in Huntsville just months ago. I believe it was January.
June.
Yeah, well, I don't know why I always mix January and June up. The J and the N get me. So we're talking about that, and I want those of you out there who would like to participate in the discussion to do so. You can call in. The U.S. number is 727-565-1599. That's country code 001. You can call the U.K. number, which is 020-813-3-6629, and that's country code 44. Or you can call us anywhere in the African world for free on Skype. Our Skype ID is Uhuru Radio, and that's all one word, all lowercase. Or you can email us at dj@uhururadio.com. So, comrade, I understand that part of the work that MPDUM has been doing leading up to the trial has been getting petitions signed. Can you speak to, like, you know, where have people signed this petition from?
Sure. People have signed the petition from Zimbabwe, from Sierra Leone, from Canada, from throughout the U.S., London, France. So we've had people sign the petition from, you know, all around the world, basically, who are making a demand that the charges, you know, were dropped against us, and uniting that attack against the Huntsville 3 was one that was really an attack that was made against the entire African community. So we really had a lot of support from people around the world who are uniting with that demand and that summary of what this attack means in the larger scheme of things.
Okay, and I know the judge in the trial was saying that he couldn't make the decision then. He's going to come to a decision sometime this coming week. Can you say what MPDUM is doing in the meantime?
Yes, we're also saying that we want to be able to continue with the calling campaign that we had last week. Actually, we asked for people on last Tuesday and Thursday to call in to Mayor Tommy Battle's office, Councilman Richard Showers, and Police Chief Henry Reyes, you know, asking or demanding that the charges be dropped. And we're asking now for people to call in to those same government officials, this time not demanding that the charges are dropped, but demanding that we be found innocent on all charges. And so people can actually go to NPDUM's website, www.inpdum.org, and you can go to the Hands Off the Huntsville 3 button that's on the right-hand side of the home page, and you can get all of the contact information for those government officials. And that, we're asking people to email and call in. And we want to really show appreciation to all the people from around the world who participated in last week's email and call-in campaign. We understand that the officials received hundreds of calls and emails, and we, you know, want to call on folks to, you know, participate, you know, in this week's call-in as well. And we understand that we should be getting a verdict by this Friday. And so we're asking people to call in between the hours of 8 and 4 for this week, also to the same government officials that you can find on the NPDUM website.
And I know I was trying to call, and I couldn't get through during the date set for the call. And I was trying to call and couldn't get through, so I went ahead and emailed all them jokers. And yeah, so yeah, definitely, folks, even if you ain't able to get in a call because everybody else is calling in, you can email, let them know somehow, you know, that this is a problem, and it's a problem for us, and if they don't come back with the right verdict, it will be problematic for them. Is there anything else that you like to say, you know, as we close this segment out?
Yeah, I mean, I just really want to say that as African people, we have a responsibility to organize ourselves to not only defend ourselves from the kinds of attacks that we see the police making on us daily, but to be able to organize ourselves to put an end to the policies that make it possible for these kinds of attacks to happen, and then for the police to be found not guilty, or for people who have been attacked to be found guilty on bogus charges that have been placed on them. We've got to be able to defend ourselves and to be able to make it be known that it's not okay, it's not open season on African people, and that we're going to sit back and allow it to happen. We have to become organized. We have to join the International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement. We have to fight for community control over the police and community control over everything that affects us as African people. And so I just really want for all of the listeners who may not be members of NPDUM to go to the website, join the International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement, the only organization that is struggling to make sure that the power is rest in the hands of our people, and that we stop being at the mercy of a government and of a state that has nothing but attack and venom for our people. So, you know, again, I just want to appreciate everybody for participating in the call-in. Please continue your calls and your emails this week. And I want to just say uhuru, comrade, and thank you for having me on the show.
Thank you for being on, and I'm sure we're going to be talking about this more once that verdict comes back. I really appreciate you coming on, you know, to discuss this with us. And actually, it looks like we've got a caller. Hold on, let him in. Uhuru, caller, you on the air?
Uhuru.
Uhuru.
What's going on, comrade? I was listening to what Comrade Aisha was saying, and I think it's important that, you know, this kind of struggle is made known, because a lot of people feel, you know, after Obama became the president, that somehow, you know, all struggles or injustices have ceased. And currently, we're involved in a case up in Jacksonville. It was a young man that was at a Waffle House eating breakfast, and two white guys attacked him with forks and knives, calling him, you know, racial names and what have you. And they're trying to charge his brother with murder. But similarly, just like there was a lot of support for Comrade Aisha, you know, we were able to organize that family into a committee and get people to call in and to the state's attorney's office and what have you, and demonstrate support for that, for what's going on. But I think cases like what Comrade Aisha had brought up is very important, because number one, we have to stand for our rights as a people, because the police are not going to stop doing what the police do just because Obama is in office, as some people may think, and in fact, they may do it even more. So I just want to say that we have to support this petition, support what's going on, and, you know, to know that these are not isolated incidences. It's happening in Huntsville. It's happening all over the world that Aisha cited, and it's happening up there in Jacksonville, Florida as well. For that case, I was just going to tell people that they can, you know, just Google search Barry Correll's name, BarryCarrell, and they'll find a petition and some information about it. But basically, it was a self-defense case. He shot these two white boys that you know, was attacking him and his female friend that was at this Waffle House in Jacksonville. And, you know, he tried to do what he had to do. But they charged him with murder, and we're just trying to make sure that that doesn't happen, because we have a right to self-defense. We have a right to protect ourselves from police violence and protect others from police violence and aggression. So I just want to say uhuru to the comrade, and, you know, good luck with the case. And, you know, obviously we'll be staying tuned to try to make sure that the right verdict that you suggested, Yabinga, comes out. So,
right on, right on.
Uhuru.
And anything you want to say to that, Aisha?
No, I just appreciate the caller for, you know, for raising that the case of his brother again as an example that it's never an isolated incident, and that's what we have to remember as African people, that what's happening to us is not happening to us because we're some individual out in the world that you know, but that this is an attack. The attacks that are made on us as individuals are made on us because we're as a people, not as individuals. And so, you know, there are any number of cases that we could talk about, and that's why we need to be organized. We need to be organized so that we're not dealing with these things as individual, isolated incidences, but as a general attack that's made against our community.
Indeed.
And be prepared to struggle against these policies that allow these attacks to happen and you know, and that kind of thing. So, again, I just want to express appreciation, you know, for, you know, being able to have this discussion today. And thank you again, Comrade Binga, for having me on the show.
Indeed. The calls are falling in right now, Comrade. We got another caller coming. Who caller, you on there?
Uhuru, Binga, yeah, this is Scientist from London.
Uhuru, comrade.
Uhuru, yeah, I just wanted to just ask, basically, in Huntsville, how the people have responded to the case, and, you know, are people actually coming and getting involved in MP Dumb, etc., in Huntsville?
Uhuru, comrade Scientist, yeah, thanks for that question. People are becoming involved in the case. And becoming involved in the committee that MPDUM has established to address police containment in the African community. And I think part of what we had been involved in Huntsville even prior to the Huntsville 3 case was organizing around other cases of police violence and police murder here in Huntsville. And so we kind of have established a history of of resistance in Huntsville within the last, 2 years that we've been building MPDOM here. And we've been able to win other folks who have, been trying to make struggle as individuals, behind things that have happened to them in terms of police violence and those kind of things. So, yeah, I think this case has really given us an opportunity to continue to push for community control over the police. And one of the things that we're really going to be struggling around, even beyond the Huntsville 3 case, is making the struggle to have a community-based police review board with subpoena power. And we're already gearing up and developing a strategy to be able to really make that a serious campaign that we're going to be waging in the community. And people really seem to have unity with the fact that that's something that's absolutely needed in the community. So, yeah, people have really been able to unite around the work that we've been doing here locally.
Good, good. I also wanted to ask, how is the situation in terms of with police in Huntsville with the community mobilization? Are police starting to act a little differently? Because I know sometimes, when the community gets mobilized around certain issues, for instance, we had a march in Brixton yesterday, and the police really have to kind of move back a little bit when the people step up. So I wanted to also find out how the police reaction to the mobilization of the community, what that has been as well.
Well, I think there's a lot more that really can happen here locally to really win more of our people into this process of struggling against police containment. So I can't say that I've noticed a real difference in the way the police have been moving since we've been, since we initiated this campaign. But I do fully expect that, something similar to that, which you guys experienced in London, will happen here as more people, participate in this campaign. Because even what we've seen, even when we look at the situation with our case in particular, the police were just harassing people at will. Mm-hmm. And when they were unable to intimidate us, when people really began to unite, say, stop harassing people. Stop harassing these people. Why are you harassing them? They had to really, take a step back and reevaluate how they were going to move. And they determined that they wanted to remove us from the situation to keep, the people from really responding to their aggression towards the community. So really what we see is the police typically move the way they do in the community because there's not much resistance. But as resistance, mounts, They have to take a look at moving a little bit differently. So I think there's a lot more work though that we can and will be doing in the coming months around the campaign for a community-based police review board to in the city, and probably we'll see some different kind of movement from the police thereafter. But got a lot more work to do on that end.
That's it. Well, we'll be calling in on Friday, sending the emails and that, so the struggle continues. Uhuru, comrade.
Uhuru. Appreciate that, scientist. The thing is that same struggle, for police community review board with subpoena powers is something that we're involved in here in St. Petersburg, Florida, where they murdered young Javon Dawson, shot this kid at a graduation party, and it's like you said, it's not isolated. It's no isolated incidents. We got the case of Brother Correll up there in Jacksonville, of Javon Dawson here in St. Petersburg, Florida, of the Huntsville 3 in Alabama, so many cases, all over, not just the U.S., but also, the world. We just were speaking with scientists based in London, where the same type of stuff is happening right there. We got another email that came in. This is from Sister Des, who says, Uhuru, she asks, what would be the outcome? Hoping not, but if the judge does not rule accordingly, what will happen to the members?
Well, there is a possibility that should we be found guilty, that there is jail time associated with each of the charges. There's possibility that should we be found guilty, that the the judge could issue some jail time or fines, court costs, that kind of thing. And in fact, the city attorney did say that should we be found guilty, that he would press for maximum jail time in the case, in each of the you know, cases. And so that is a possibility. You know, we have to really determine how, you know, how we will move beyond that. Certainly, I would think that would we be found guilty, that we would go into an appeal to get a jury trial. And so those are the kinds of things that, you know, we're in the process of discussing how we would move from there. But that, those are possibilities. And I think the, you know, the city has really made an effort to try to, I think, stamp out any kind of resistance in this city to these policies. And I think they would like to be able to sweep this case up under the rug, you know, but they see that there's motion around it. So I don't really know, you know, how things, of course, will turn out next Friday. But either way, there's going to be resistance, whether we found guilty, whether we found not guilty. There's going to be continued resistance on the part of MPDOM here locally to organize our community to end the policy of police containment and to, you know, to struggle for a community-based police board with the subpoena power. But we're going to definitely keep people abreast of the situation as it unfolds.
And, you know, this is what makes it so significant, you know, for folks out there listening to participate in this campaign, to do the call-ins, to do the emails, because the reality is what this is an attempt to make it to, you know, say you can't resist, you know, injustice happening to you. You cannot resist injustice in your community. That's what the state is attempting to do here, and we have to say no, that's not the case. We have to win, and so we got to be involved in this campaign to win. Again, thank you so much, Dr. Aisha Fields, for being on to talk with us about the case of the Huntsville 3. Like I said, I hopefully we can talk about it some more on next week following the verdict.
Yes, comrade. Thank you, and thank you to all the comrades and the brothers and sisters and allies who participated in this campaign. And I just invite and encourage everybody to join the only movement capable of winning freedom for African people, and that is the Uhuru Movement. Join the Uhuru Movement right now. So thank you very much, Comrade Binga, for having me on your show. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So we're going to go to break right now. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about Thanksgiving and what this holiday, when I was in school, we used to call it Helladay, one of the Helladays, what it means and what it means for us to be celebrating such occasion. So stay tuned here on Africa Live on WhoRadio.com.
Uh-huh, yeah. Check this out. One time for your mind.
Uh-huh. Jumped in his things.
Ghetto instrumentals.
Check it out.
From gorillas to gangsters, projects to pyramids. The U.S. government is conducting experiments. The terror commenced with slavery like Maryland's when we was taken from Africa, called Americans. We worked all day and slept in the slave quarters. I used to be the overseer, now the Jake's on us. We still live as slaves, trapped in the same borders. Only difference now, we go to work with 8 quarters on the train, telling ourselves to maintain on our way to misery, coming home to the same bullshit. The pigs walk the block with 4 clips, trying to send us to the place preachers talk about in pulpits. Who you with? Someone set you plain. Don't be from the wrong hood, that can get you bang on the rail. That shit got many brothers blasted. It got caught on the wrong side of Mother Gaston. The state gave us crack to make the people struggle backwards, to make sure war against the state was unimagined. Part of the war they was making on the masses, to make sure the black population stayed trapped in
the state by the state. The state carry weight in and out of state. A fam take it day by the day. That's how it is when you're trapped by the states. Trapped in the states by the state. Bad guy snatched by the jakes. Africans take a day by the day. That's how it is when you trapped by the states.
On the border of Guinea and Sierra Leone, neo-colonial soldiers is heavily armed to keep the masses of the Africans separate from our resources getting ripped off by these imperialist hogs. It's so hot it truly could pour till we control the fruits of our soil. We in pursuit of our gold, we end up traveling to North America in pursuit of resources that we were severed from. But if you're looking for a better life, forget it done. You came to the terror dome when niggas getting hung. Matter of fact, we would leave if we had consciousness, but the white ruling class control the politics. They're telling us to integrate into the populace and be a good house nigga like Obama is. But the fact is, Africans is held captive from a land we was fractured.
Trapped in the state by the state. The state carry weight in and out of state. Our fam take it day by the day. That's how it is when you're trapped by the states. Trapped in the states by the state. My combat got snatched by the jits. Africans take it day by the day. That's how it is when you're trapped by the state.
We at war with house niggas and police. Winters with no heat. Junk food and corner stores leave us with no teeth. Don't fuck with no beef. Take worms or take what you earn. Even looking like you don't eat. With all the bullshit going on in my community, it make me wonder what more these crackers could try to do to me. Anything that you could think of, they throw me. From the slum lords to the local fiends, we don't sleep. The shots ring out regularly in the middle of the night. Clap back or don't eat. It's that simple. It's not a riddle. The only issue, who to put these slugs into? Who responsible for the bullshit we go into? We say the state got us trapped in this misery, living in the ghetto. Some say we in prison in the mental. I disagree. We hold hostage militarily.
Trapped in the state by the state. The state carry weight in and out of state. Our fam take it day by the day. That's how it is when you're trapped by the states. Trapped in the states by the state. My combat got snatched by the jets. Africans take it day by the day. That's how it is when you're trapped by the states.
That was Trigger Nom with Game on the Tool. That is tight. I like that track right there. That's the joint. That's the joint. That's the new joint from Trigger Nom. You're gonna be hearing that here on the Hoor Radio because I like that. So I know I'm gonna be playing it. Anyway, this is Africa Live. I'm your host in Binghamton, Zimbabwe. And I want to say a little something about Thanksgiving. I know in the next, not this week, but next week, a number of people will be, eating turkey and you know, other things, you know, with their families, celebrating this thing they call Thanksgiving. I think it's important for us to understand what it is that where this comes from. First of all, it's important for colonized peoples to define reality for ourselves. There is a saying, as long as the hunter tells the story, the lion will never win. And it is a statement that, as long as you don't have control over your own ability to define the world, your own ability to define reality, then you're at the mercy of whoever it is that is defining reality. It's a statement of the importance of ideas, and I think we can't overstate the significance of ideas, because ideas inform how one moves. Ideas inform you of how you see yourself and how you see your capacity to change the world around you. It affects how you act to change phenomena around you. The saying could easily be, as long as Africans in the U.S. believe we were born under a collard green leaf in the U.S., we'll accept our oppression and our isolation from the rest of our people and our Africa. Ideas are significant, and like I said, however you define reality impacts on how you interact with a phenomena in the world. And so saying that to say, you know, to understanding that we look at the question of holidays, and the reality is that when you look at holidays, you know, holidays that are celebrated, be they religious holidays or be they national holidays, the purpose of holidays are to help to consolidate a kind of a national consciousness, to consolidate people into a national consciousness. And so, you know, you have holidays that help to give shape to you know, an identity, you know, help to tell you who you are in relationship with other people. And so, you know, they serve particular interests, you know, and they serve the interests of the particular nation that is doing the consolidation to it, you know. And so when you look at holidays like Thanksgiving, you know, holidays like Columbus Day, like President's Day, and the various other holidays that are celebrated in the U.S. I know people outside of the U.S. may not be familiar with some of these, but these are different holidays that are celebrated in the U.S., celebrating people who and events that were responsible, played a role in making the U.S. what it is. Of course, those of us who are informed about the world recognize what the U.S. is to us, recognize the fact that the U.S. is a parasite. And so if you celebrate holidays, you know, that are celebrating its ability to become a parasite, its ability to continue to exist as a parasite, then what you do is you celebrate your own oppression. You celebrate this parasitic relationship that keeps Africans, the indigenous peoples of the Americas, and others in you know, some of the worst kind of conditions. So I want to briefly take a look at Thanksgiving itself. We only got a few minutes left, and so, you know, based on the study of documents from Holland and letters and reports from colonial history here in the occupied territory that is called the United States of America, anthropologist William B. Newell talks about Thanksgiving beginning at Thanksgiving as a celebration having begun with a massacre in 1637. Where about 700 Pequot Indians were gathering for an annual green corn dance in the area that is now known as Groton, Connecticut. And, you know, and they were in a building that functioned like a church when they were attacked by you know, these gangsters from English, from the, you know, these English and Dutch colonialists who attacked this building filled with 700 men, women, and children, and surrounded the building and ordered everybody out of the building. And as people started to come out of the building, they started shooting the people down. And in those who would not come out of the building, they ended up getting burned alive because these European thieves, these gangsters, you know, set the building on fire. And the following day, the governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony declared a day of Thanksgiving. And basically thanking God for them having been able to carry out this massacre. This is information that that comes from, you know, anthropologist William B. Newell, based on historical documents from Holland and the colonial documents here in what they called the U.S. Now, I got to say, this kind of reminds me of the attack on the Uhura House in November